Welcome back. I hope you all managed to get some coffee eventually. You probably all know me. I'm Martin Redfern. For 35 years, I've produced science programmes for BBC Radio. And as a journalist, the secret is to surround yourself with panellists who are good at speaking. So I'm feeling very happy today to have three of our top scientists from the network. I think I have both the easiest job and the hardest job. The easiest job because I know each of these three wonderful people could fill more than an hour and a half with words of wisdom. The hardest task is that I've got to shut them up. But I've got the gong. So let us come under candle rules. So, transforming science. I guess science is a subset of worldviews, or is it bigger? I used to think that science was it ought to be everything there is. It's just that it doesn't talk about everything that there is. And maybe that's the transformation that we're going to discuss today. John Clark set a good precedent by quoting G.K. Chesterton. I will do the same. He said that the universe is the smallest space into which a man can fit his head. you don't want to listen to me, you want to listen to these wonderful people here who, I don't know if you realise just how lucky we are having Bernard, Peter and Marilyn involved in the network. These are three people who each individually should be being considered in a fair world by the Nobel Prize Committee. They have their public face where they have to be very careful and stick to nice material things. But we are lucky enough to see their other hemisphere where they might integrate that with a greater world awareness. And so in the next 45 minutes, maximum 15 minutes each, please, without hesitating, deviating or repeating, and I have my buzzer, we're going to take on the cosmos, the mind and the body. So without further ado, Bernard, tell us about cosmology and transforming science.
Thank you, Martin. Obviously, the first thing that strikes you about this title is it's highly ambiguous. Is transforming an adjective or a verb? Are we talking about how science itself is transformed? Are we talking about how science transforms us? And I think the message I want to get across in part is that science transforms us, though that's not maybe the way in which scientists themselves normally think. Now, the second point to make is that, of course, science is a huge enterprise involving many, many different fields. One often thinks of science as a sort of pyramid in which you have physics at the bottom, and then you have chemistry, and then you've got biology, and then you've got neuroscience, and then you've got psychology, and then you've got social sciences. And we're going to hear about those. Peter's going to talk about neuroscience. Marilyn's going to talk about biology. I'm going to talk about physics. Now, physics is sometimes described as the queen of the sciences because it's there at the base. It sort of underlies everything. But, of course, all of these sciences are interconnected. But when we talk about the transforming of science, we must bear in mind that all these different branches of science are involved and transform in different ways. But I'm just going to focus on physics. I actually began my PhD in 1973, which was exactly 40 years ago. I started with the SMN, and it is just remarkable how much physics has changed since I began my PhD. Not because of me, I should say, but you need to make a distinction between two aspects of physics. There's the developments in theoretical or fundamental physics, and there's developments in applied physics, the technology of physics. And actually, these affect us in very different ways. When we talk about applied physics and technology, that essentially is what really affects our bodies. Okay, this is what affects our lives. And you know, I can just talk about just a few things like satellites, lasers, the internet, microprocessors in computers, nanotechnology, high-temperature superconductors, Josephson junctions, all of these are technological developments that in some amazing ways have affected our...
Scanners
have affected our lives. But actually, I'm a theoretical physicist, and I tend to be more interested in the developments in theoretical science. And they are actually deeper. They, in some sense, affect, I would say, they affect our minds, but in some sense, I think they also affect our souls, because those really deep questions about the nature of the universe and the large and the smaller scales. Now, actually, one of the important technological developments was the invention of PowerPoint. And I would normally be using PowerPoint now to get across my ideas, because a picture is 1,000 words. But PowerPoint is forbidden. So I'm not going to use PowerPoint. But nevertheless, I think you might... I think, in a sense, one of the arguments against PowerPoint is it's too much information. And I think one of the differences between applied science, applied physics, and sort of fundamental physics is that it's sort of information versus wisdom. And I think one good thing about getting away from PowerPoint maybe is it de-emphasizes the information and emphasizes more the wisdom, maybe. Nevertheless, I do want to sort of try and get across the sort of way in which our view of the universe has changed through studying physics. And the point about physics is that the history of physics is looking at the world on ever larger and smaller scales, using ever more powerful instruments. And you're all, I've given talks about this, you're aware of the outward journey of physics and the changes that that has led to as we've gone from the geocentric to the heliocentric to the galactocentric to the cosmocentric view. In doing that, we've also discovered all sorts of amazing new phenomena like black holes and quasars and pulsars and the Big Bang and the microwave background, dark matter, dark energy, 70% of the universe is in dark energy, gravitational waves, wormholes. These are all ideas that have actually come up in the last 40 years. It's only in the last 40 years that these have really become mainstream. And the other thing about that outward journey, of course, it's the domain of relativity theory. On the inward journey, you know how we've probed ever smaller scales, we've discovered atoms and quarks. We've discovered the unification of the forces, the electroweak unification, the grand unified theories, amalgamating of the strong force. We know there's the standard model of particle physics, culminating with the discovery of the Higgs particle this year, only exactly 40 years after it was first postulated. So the Higgs particle was postulated, the SMN was formed as well. And now we've got the idea of string theory and M theory and extra dimensions and all sorts of things. And also, this is the domain of quantum theory. So the discovery in the macroscopic domain is the domain of relativity. Those in the microscopic domain, that is the realm of quantum theory. Now, actually, I was trying to understand, how can I get across this idea without PowerPoint, you know, because I have PowerPoint slides to get this across beautifully. And I had a brainwave last night. I was going to put on a little sort of, like a work of art, really, a little drama in which a few people were going to help me with a timeline across the room, representing the key moments, key developments in our understanding of the macro world and the micro world and things. But then it was a great idea when I went to bed last night, but then I woke up and had breakfast and I discussed it with people and realized it's not going to work. So I'm not going to do that. But I just, at least, I hope you understand that you are aware at some level of all these amazing discoveries in microphysics and macrophysics, which represent, and of course in applied physics, which represent that progress which I'm talking about. And I can't go through it in detail. So I just want to make some more general comments. That the main thing, of course, is that what we've learned from this expansion of the consciousnesses to the ever larger and smaller scales is that there is this amazing unity in the universe. Everything is connected. There is amazing lawfulness. And in some sense, the macro and the micro sort of merge at the Big Bang. But I want to make some more general points rather than getting too tied into the technicalities of these developments. One of the things that people often say is that, well, it's all theory, you know, and it doesn't have much practical application. And when you get these new ideas, it's what people, especially the more philistine people, always say, it's all theory, it's not applied enough. Now, relativity, for example, they said it's all theory. Well, it wasn't long before it was producing the atomic bomb. General relativity, it's all theory, it will never be measurable, and indeed it never was until about the 1960s. Now we use it routinely all the time in GPS and all sorts of things. Quantum theory, it's all theoretical, no practical application. Not at all. We now know it has huge numbers of applications. A myriad of technological devices depend on quantum theory, most recently, of course, in encoding. And your banker's bank card and keeping the number secret and things like that. Dark energy. Now let's think a bit to the future. Well, we know 70% of the universe is dark energy, but it's all theory. I bet you within another, by the end of the century, they'll be using dark energy. Maybe even a source of energy, you know, to solve our world's problems. Higher dimensions. I'm very keen on higher dimensions. Pure theory. Okay, no connection to reality. I bet you it won't be long before they're using higher dimensions as in, you know, Star Trek to sort of go through hyperspace and visit other galaxies, whatever. So be very careful of those people who say it's all theory. You know, when they discovered the electron, the Gladstone or something said, what good is an electron? And I think it was, Faraday said, well, I don't know now, but it won't be long before you're taxing it. Same with all these ideas. Yeah. So that's the other point I want to get across, that don't just think it's all theory. It's not long before science becomes technological, and that's when it really impacts. Now, but now I want to ask another question. As you know, one of the great, one of the issues the SMN is always pioneering is that we have to get away from that materialistic reductionist worldview, which is what mainstream science says. But actually, when we look at the progress of physics, which I've just outlined, what does it tell us? At first sight, when you look at the glorious triumph of physics in helping us understand the macro and the micro world, in that lovely image of the cosmic Ouroboros, which I would use if I had a picture, at first sight, that does not fit in with the SMN, you know, ethos, because actually that's saying the materialist reductionist view has been triumphant. It's given us a wonderful coherent view of the universe, but one in which humankind seem to play no role at all. As Weinberg said, the more we understand the universe, the more meaningless it seems to become. But the other thing is that actually, and this relates to something that Horace said, actually, the point of view I take is that actually the new theories of physics are not reductionist at all. They are not materialistic. They open up whole new levels of reality which completely destroy the common sense classical view of the world. And so in that sense, although most working scientists don't talk about this too much, I think it's implicit that actually these new theories really are changing our worldview in a way that makes man, if you like, mankind, more important.
That's 10 minutes.
Thank you. Now, but one thing to bear, let me just sort of illustrate this. There are various key words which are taboo, okay, have been taboo in science. Let me give you a word like anthropic. Okay, the A word. Now, I started writing about the anthropic principle shortly after, in the 70s. Okay, in those days, it was a taboo word. I was writing with people like Martin Rees, which sort of protected me, but it was still regarded as crazy. Okay, now, 40 years later, to many, it's still a taboo word in some quarters. It's maybe 50% of physicists, but now it's respectable. Some of the greatest physicists in the world, Weinberg, Hawking, Wilczek, you know, it's all anthropic. So you shouldn't get the impression everyone believes in it, but it's now respectable. Let's take another taboo word, consciousness. Okay, the C word. Now, again, that was taboo. But now, and we'll hear about this from Peter, but now, actually, endless meetings about consciousness and physics and neuroscience and things like that. We can begin to talk about consciousness. Again, it's still a taboo word in certain quarters, but it's becoming more acceptable. And then the other word is the S word, which who referred to the S word last night? well, anyway, you know what I mean by the S word, spirituality. That's still pretty taboo. I mean, even among the people who talk about consciousness. But nevertheless, I think it's edging in, because I think the key point of which we learn from the developments in modern physics is that mind actually is important. Consciousness and mind are important. And once you've got mind, you're edging into spirituality. And so my actual dream, if you like, is that there will be a paradigm, physics, the new paradigm shift will be one in which physics accommodates consciousness and mental phenomena and spiritual phenomena. And some of you have heard me talk about this. I think we have to have a unified view which incorporates all of those things. And I think, you know, I have my own view as to what will that be, the sort of hard-dimensional reality structure. It doesn't matter whether that's right, but I'm saying is my bet is that there will be a new paradigm which will do that. And let me just be a little bit more precise. The two great paradigms of physics are quantum theory in the micro world and relativity theory in the macro world. The great goal of physics is to unify those two paradigms in the final theory, if you like, of quantum gravity. Physics talks about having a theory of everything, being a theory of everything. It's nowhere near a theory of everything. It doesn't even begin to talk about consciousness. It's just a theory of particles. So, but there will be a theory of everything, and that's going to fuse quantum theory and relativity. And I bet that that fused theory, quantum gravity or whatever you want to call it, will actually accommodate consciousness and mentality. Yeah. And in terms of the Ouroboros, it's where the very large meets the very small, where the snake eats its own tail. That, I think, is where mind is. I think it's to do with higher dimensions, but never mind that. That's just my personal obsession. Also, I was asked to talk about parapsychology. I can't talk about... I just made a decision not to talk parapsychology because that was another 14 minutes. But maybe Peter will talk about that. Parapsychology, to me, also ultimately must be based on physics. Well, anyway, that's all I have time for, but I hope that serves a purpose. Yeah.
Admirably done, Bernard. Thank you. If time is in the realm of physics, you're its master. And so, from the outer world of the cosmos to the inner world of consciousness, or is it the other way around? I'm never quite sure. Peter.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to talk today. Neuroscience in 15 minutes? Well, of course, simple. Let's try some basic principles. Let us go back to the time of the Greeks and see what it was that they found important about the brain, the ventricles. Why did they find the ventricles important? Because if you have a brain and you cut it, the cortex and everything dissolves into, deteriorates, but the ventricular structure remains. So the brains were all ventricles. And, of course, that led on to theories about the humours. And as you come more into our modern view of the world, the humours were connected to the body, and you've got liver humours and bile humours, but it was all coming from the ventricular system. So it looks as if technology is going to drive neuroscience. But there are two ways we can look at neuroscience. We can look at it from the inside. In other words, I can do it from experience. I can do it from my conscious perception of what goes on. And I can do it from the outside. I can stimulate a frog's legs and see it kick. Well, the next great leap forward was, first of all, a microscope, which showed us brain structure and the staining of slides. And then the idea that this pneumatic brain, because we came from Galen, was in fact, we were all a series of pipes. And there were pipes in there and their little valves, and nerves, in fact, opened these valves. Ridiculous now. But was it then? No, it was cutting-edge stuff. And what about the whole idea of electricity when that came in? Well, it changed brain views, absolutely. We became telephone exchanges. And you can see the way that information came in and spread out within the brain. But the point I want you to get is that we're following technology, just following technology. And now, of course, we've changed again. We're no longer looking at electricity. We're no longer looking at purely electrical theories of the brain. We're looking at, although we don't say it, we're looking, in fact, at blood flow. And this is with our modern scanning methods. So what we've got now is a picture of blood flow in the brain. But it was thought, until a recent paper, to be blood flow within the neurons. It told us how the neurons were acting. The latest paper says, no, it's not in the neurons. It's in the synapses between the neurons. It's not actually telling us how the neurons work. It's telling us how the synapses work. So now, again, the pattern has changed. But I want you to think of another major constricting factor for neuroscience, and that is that there is no one brain. You get this huge culling of cells at 10 months. If you haven't heard a sound at 10 months, you take those cells out, or the receptor system, and you won't hear it unless you go through a really strong training process. So when we heard about the use of LSD, in order that people can experience that fully, 10 months babies should have it. then they don't cull those systems which are there. Then the next culling is 8, 9, and the final culling starts in adolescence when we remodel our brains for the adult brain. So the brain isn't a stationary organ. And in fact, we've learned recently that it can keep on growing. But it's much more interesting than that, because there isn't a brain in the sense that it's totally defined. For example, if you take kittens and blind them to vertical structures during their developmental period, they don't see them. That means that those kittens are blind to vertical structures. That means in our culture that when we're brought up, we're going to be blind to a whole set of factors which we don't even notice we're blind to. And again, it's all to do with whether we, in fact, have seen these or not. So that is a very important point which you have to keep continually in mind. If that is true, and I look at Japanese brains or Chinese brains and Western brains, are they different? Yes, they are. For example, birdsong is heard differently in the Japanese brain to how it's heard in the Western brain. So they're really quite marked differences, and so the thinking processes will be different because they're defined by their culture. The next point that I would like to make is that when we come to actually do our neuroscience, the models we make, as I said, are those which are current around us following the technology. But if you do that, then there are really very wide thinkers who have dealt with brains all their lives who say, listen, we're missing important tricks. And I'm going to talk about Penfield. Penfield had his electrodes in the brains everywhere. He understood the way that neurons connected, and he said that there's no doubt that when the great aspects of mind come into force, they are reflected in brain physiology. But he then went on to say, when I summarize everything that I've learned about the brain, and when I summarize everything that I've learned about mind, they're different. And this difference has always been elided. There is no question that what Penfield said is correct. You cannot measure the mind electrically. Reflections of it, yes, but not the mind. So the mind, from the point of view of neuroscience, is only there because we have a mind which analyzes the data. You couldn't, for example, do a scan of somebody and attribute meaning to it if you didn't have somebody who was reporting on those experiences that you want to allocate to the brain. So, in fact, our neuroscience only takes place in consciousness and in the consciousness of people. Now, I think one of the ways that I want to talk about how neuroscience should go, if you're going to use the brain, you're going to come up against, if I can call it, the Penfield problem. The problem that you're using a technology to try to understand brain structures, and that technology may show you something about the structures, but not about what causes the changes. And so you have to look for outliers. In other words, are there situations in which mind and brain seem to be different? And the answer to that is yes, there are. And the near-death experience, particularly the cardiac arrest near-death experience, I think is just one such thing, when in fact the brain goes down, but consciousness remains. So there you've got a split. When else can you look at this? You can look at this also when you're dying, because then consciousness starts to fractionate, brain function fractionates, the mental states of the dying become a wonderful ground for looking at the relationships between brain function and mental states. I now just want to go on to what would have happened in our science if we had taken the internal view. In other words, if we had looked at subjective experiences which go on, then we would have defined a region, which I'm sure David Peters will be talking about, when you look at those covert channels within the body and the brain, which transfer energy. For example, I have never heard in any scientific book about the opening of the third eye. In other words, the idea, the Arjuna chakra, the idea that there are centers which open with people who carry out certain particular techniques, not reflected in science at all. And in if I was to ask somebody, tell me about the Arjuna chakra, they'd say, where is it? I'd say it's somewhere up there. And we'd go to the scans, no Arjuna chakra. But neuroimaging and some of the meditation techniques are beginning to throw light on the way the brain works in a quite different way. And that is that they are showing that if you hold your mind still, I mean still, and are fixed in the present, it's a Zen meditation, but if you get yourself fixed in the present, cortical activity goes down dramatically, and you use subcortical structures. Now, that is a very important statement, because it means that experience isn't necessarily this highly developed cortical structures we have. There are other structures within the brain which can mediate experience like this. Now, there's just the beginnings of ideas as to what those structures might do. In some of the experiments, there is the cingulate gyrus, which is pretty low down in the hierarchy of cortical structures. And that seems to be functioning when you have some of these wider experiences. And the whole idea that you can have these very wide and complex experiences occurring from these deeper brain structures is an idea which is enormously important. So what's the future going to be? Well, first of all, we have to understand the brain is very plastic and it changes. We have to understand it's going to follow technology. And if some of you could provide a way, particularly Bernard, on how you can measure some of the energies that we talk about in the network, it would transform our understanding of neurology and neuroscience. So we need a new technology to look at that area. I think we also need to do is to look at the reflections in the brain processes of people who do have much wider and higher states of consciousness. Just to end, there is now the beginnings of a new neuroscience looking at what happens if you damage areas of cortex. For a long time, there has been an idea that you can release functions in the brain. And the concept here is that specific areas of damage can allow new talents to flower in the people where the brain damage is. Now, this leads to a quite different understanding of the brain and goes right back to William James when we think of the brain as a reducing valve rather than as a creator of everything, which I'm sure it isn't. Thank you.
Another master of time. Thank you. I don't know if you realise how lucky we are to have Marilyn in the network. She keeps quite quiet about her science usually, but she is one of the world's pioneers of the science of epigenetics, worked in the laboratory of Damon McLaren. Definitely should be up for a Nobel Prize, I would say.
I was invited.
We are delighted to have you to fill in the gap between the universe and the mind.
Thank you, Martin. Well, thanks everybody for this opportunity to talk about my favourite thing, my very favourite thing, which is science. And as you all know, I write a column for the Review on recent developments in science and medicine. I trawl the journals, the major journals throughout the year, and select the things that have happened that might be of interest, condense them and simplify them. And so I do that talking about other people's work. So today I'm just going to talk about my own work. So I'm a real hardcore reductionist scientist. I'm a molecular biologist, which is the study of life at the subcellular level, at the level of the DNA, the genes, and the proteins. And I've been an academic research scientist for 50 years now. My first published paper was 1959. And I've worked in a number of different fields. And initially I worked in DNA replication and repair in bacteria and their viruses. And that was a very exciting time because that was soon after the discovery of the structure of DNA and the elucidation of the genetic code and so on. But in the early 70s, I started to be quite bored with bacteria because, you know, they really don't do much. And I had listened to a wonderful lecture by somebody called Bonner on slime molds, slime mold amoebae. And he was doing all sorts of tricks with these amoebae to see what was the signal attracting them and things like that. And I thought, oh, I'd really like to play with them. So I started working on the slime mold amoebae, and that's a particularly wonderful organism because it exists at two levels of being. The amoebae exists as individual amoebae that just crawl around and feed on rotting vegetation and divide, and, you know, they're a bit like Highland sheep, they separate from each other. But when they run out of food, they start signaling each other and make an aggregate and form a slug, which, like the amoeba, can only move over about 10 microns or something. But the slug is a multicellular animal now, and it can move over centimetres, and it's got receptors in it front attracting it to heat, and light goes to the surface. And a third of the cells sacrifice their lives to become stalk and bear the others aloft as spore. And so I worked out all the parameters of aggregation of that serendipitously, because I had this really awful fridge that was at 8 degrees. And I used to take the amoebae home under the microscope and set the alarm, get up every hour and think if they aggregated yet, what's happening and how are they doing it. And somehow I'd missed it, you know. Suddenly there'd be a slug and I'd miss it. But this fridge, 8 degrees, seemed to sort of cut between movement and signalling in such a way, got all these lovely concentric rings to work out all the parameters of signalling and aggregation. And we used to have slug races in the dark room because they're attracted to the light, and I'd give everybody a slug and I'd give them names and put money on them. And so that was how I spent quite a few hours. And then in the 70s, I could have gone on working with slime molds. I really liked them. But the Medical Research Council decided to move me into development. Development is simply change in time, mammalian development. And here was a huge problem because it meant that I had to micronize molecular techniques a millionfold, because with bugs and amoebae and viruses, you've got millions of cells. But if you've just got an egg or a two-cell embryo, you've just got one cell. And so one of the hallmarks of my research was to work on the techniques using readily available cells and make them a million times more sensitive. And out of that came a big clinical breakthrough, which was the diagnosis of genetic disease in a single cell from an 8-cell embryo for couples who were at risk of having a baby with a severe genetic disease that would suffer and die. So that was a bit of a clinical period. And then I went on, because I was really interested how genes were turned on and off, and started working on the mechanisms which we call epigenetic mechanisms. Epi means upon, genetic means genes. These are modifications superimposed upon the genes in regulatory regions which can turn a gene off, so it's not making its product anymore, or turn it on, or up and down regulate the activity. And again, serendipitously, I was really looking for something completely else, but I discovered something called deprogramming, which is the erasure of all this information superimposed on the genes in early development. And it returns the cells back to tabula rasa, ready to make the individual. It also returns them back to having no identity and then being immortal. It's a bit like if you have no ego, you might be immortal. And that was a very important discovery that brought some new breakthroughs about understanding the origin and nature of stem cells, and now that's a big burgeoning field of regenerative medicine. And then I switched again and decided, well, I'd always thought, one always sees the similarities between cancer and early development, because cancer is cells that seem to escape out of service. All your cells in your body are in service to you, and in being in service, they're mortal. But if a cell, I thought, what might deprogram and sort of back up and form a tumour, and that's how they might start. So I set out to isolate the deprogramming genes from embryos and check them on a range of cancers, and isolated a number of really good cancer stem cell genes with a view to possibly creating a vaccine, because these genes are only expressed in a very small part of the life cycle doing deprogramming and not in your normal cells. And as you know, the problem with treatments for cancers is that they hurt your normal cells as well as the cancer cells. And then, unfortunately, I had to retire, because at that time in UCL, you had to retire as soon as you hit 65. So I have been a bit of a scientific butterfly, and this is because, fortunately, my research, nobody ever told me what I had to do or how to do it, and my whole period of research, I just was curiosity-driven, sometimes by absolute awe and wonder, and that was such a luxury, just to be able to follow what I was interested in, and the reason why I changed fields so often, because mostly people just stay in one field. And new researchers are not so lucky today, because a lot of research now is applied research. It's geared towards a desired outcome, which is very sad, because that's really very not good for making new discoveries. Now, in the network, I've been in the network for about 30 years, I think, and over the last decade or so, I've been busy trying to plea for harmony between science and spirituality and arts. And like, for instance, a talk, not either or, but both and more, embracing a paradox, or sitting on both sides of the fence and above it too. And three ways of knowing being, my scientist, my poet, and my mystic. And also defending science, because sometimes I feel words like reductionist, mechanistic, materialistic, skeptic are used in a derogatory sense about science. And for heaven's sakes, it's materialistic, mechanistic science that makes our world work. It means you can all turn on a switch and the light will come on. Your car will work, your chair you're sitting in, this building. It's reproducible by anyone, anywhere, materialist, mechanistic, reductionist science that makes our world work. So we have the luxury of all these times to think of other things. And I heard somebody in the network giving a talk, he said, "Don't tell me my consciousness is a neuron." And I thought, how reductionist of him. I mean, obviously I need my neurons to be conscious, but I also need something to be conscious of. So since I was quite small, I've always seen the between things as more important than things themselves. So it's like my neurons and things to observe, and in between that, I'm conscious. As if consciousness is also almost like the ground of being is in itself interconnectedness, but mainly our consciousness is linked to bodily concerns and our survival, but can be liberated, as I've recently had ketamine for pain. It was wonderful. What did I want to say next? And what about skeptic? Scientists have to be skeptics. It's because we're skeptics, it's because we doubt, it's because we question that we can uncover bogus information that quite often is really dangerous. Somebody can propagate wrong information, the press does it all the time, and it can be really dangerous. We must be skeptics. A scientist has to disprove his hypothesis. Imagine a scientist with a pet hypothesis. He's going to cherry pick the data, so he's going to be right. He's going to ignore contradictions and anomalies, experimental artifact, ignore that. And he's going to not do the right controls. He wants to be right. So that is death to science, having a pet hypothesis. We must disprove our hypothesis. We are all skeptics. Now, I mentioned, I argued about this three-dimensional being, the scientist, the mystic, and the poet. Recently, I've been putting the mystic up the top of my triangle, which is interesting. Something's going on there. And I had to learn this because early on in the 70s, I was following a spiritual master in India, and I was wearing orange and necklaces and changed my name to Maldeva Jana, walked into the lab like this. And I actually didn't sort of, I was so stupid because I didn't realize why everybody was looking at me like I was completely mad. And it was actually my spiritual master who said that we are three-dimensional beings. We're scientist, we're poet, and we're mystic. We all are. And you mustn't take your mystic and poet into the lab, and you mustn't take your scientist into a love relationship. These are separate and different ways of knowing and being. We're all scientists, objective, rational, logical, interested in facts, evidence, pros, cons, reproducible by anyone, anywhere. We're all scientists. We're all poets, the stuff of imagination, lover of beauty, experiential truth. What's true for me experientially is valid and true. Doesn't matter if it's true for you or not. Subjectively, it's valid for me. And the poet is stuff of imagination, of dreams, intuition, and hunches. And we're all mystics, transcendental, universal laws, macrocosm equals microcosm, a bigger picture, and so on. And these are separate ways of knowing and being, the outer, the inner, and transcendental too. And we mustn't ever try to merge, blend, integrate, average these ways. I could go into this, I could give you examples, but I don't have time. They are separate. And to pit them against each other, science versus spirituality, science versus mysticism, they're not in the same ballpark. It really makes me cringe when these arguments are set up against each other. And there's always a tendency to make something else wrong to make you more right, rather than seeing the truth and the rightness in these different ways. And these should be balanced. If you're not balanced, you're not equally spending time in your scientist, your poet, and mystic, you'll have this same struggle and disharmony in your view of the outer world. Now, I better get on to some science.
You've had 10 minutes.
I've had 10 minutes. Okay, science. Again, like Bernard says, I can't really tell you much science without a PowerPoint. My mystic and my poet can talk without a PowerPoint, but my scientist has got formulae and it's got structures and it's got statistical analysis and diagrams, which are sort of needed. Now, my science goes, what I want to say is that I can take my reductionist science from a single DNA molecule in a single cell, I can take that all the way up to the ground of being, and that's what I'm about to do. So, epigenetics. I was interested in the program. And the programming of genes and the inter-between of things and the interface where things see each other or interact. And a large section of my work was about how our genes are programmed by our environment, the mechanism of receiving information at the level of modifying the expression of our genes. We called it nature and nurture. Never nature versus nurture. Nature and nurture meet at an interface. It's in between that matters. Now, every cell of your body has 20,000 genes, but you've got about 100 different cell types in your body. You've got nerve, muscle, gut, skin, etc. And these are obviously different cells. And this is because they have different cohorts and subpopulation of genes, active and inactive. And this happens during fetal development in the womb by orchestration of development, what tissues are next to other tissues, whether on the outside or inside of balls of cells, and so anyway, lots of signals, causes the programming of the tissues of the developing fetus to make hearts and lungs and livers and so on. But the genes of the fetus are also being programmed by the mother's environment, whether she's stressed or peaceful, whether she's smoking, drinking, having a good diet, whether she's resting or whatever. She's got circulating informational molecules that are circulating through the fetus too. So the fetus can be permanently programmed for stress, turning off the glucocorticoid receptor gene in the hippocampus if that mother is stressed. When the baby is born, there's a new environment. The baby's coming into a new environment, different physical, nutritional, emotional, psychological. If that baby is suffering bad parenting, abandonment, abuse, neglect, then there are about 250 genes, and we know what these genes are that are turned off in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is also smaller. And so that child is programmed for life with sustained abuse. I mean, you can drop the baby now and then or lose your temper once or twice, and that won't matter. But sustained abuse will end up programming genes permanently. I haven't got time to talk about reversibility. There's not much known about it yet. And secondly, and most importantly, we were the first to show, and others have since shown, that the turning off of that gene, in my case, I was studying the methylation of a DNA-based cytosine, that turning off signal can go through the sperm and egg. So it can go through the next generation. So according to how you're living your life, you can actually program your children and your grandchildren. You can program their life view, their expectations, their where they see the world. And this is called Lamarckian inheritance, and Darwin also believe this to be true, but it was thrown out by the DNA central dogma. The DNA is the master molecule for the past 50 years, but now it's coming back, and definitely the way we live our lives is passed through our children. And finally, I want to say one last thing about environment. You thinking your environment is this room, it's hot outside, Horsley Park is your environment, but your environment goes to the core of your being, to the edge of the cosmos, and by far, in my opinion, I hypothesize, have to disprove this now, that the major influencing environment programming your genes is your thoughts and your imagination. Imagine that you're frightened. Imagine you're in a very dark road. You're about to be mugged. Your skin temperature changes. Your heart rate changes. Your breathing changes. Your pupils dilate. The blood goes from your stomach to your muscles. Everything in your body is fired by your imagination and your thoughts. Your imagination fires your neurology and physiology, same as the real thing, Pavlov. Pavlov also saw this turning off transmarginal inhibition with abuse. So I think use affects function. Now, in a nutshell, there is hard evidence, hardcore reductionist scientific molecular evidence at the level of specific activity of specific known genes that you are what you think. The epigenetic effects of your thoughts are going to be transmitted to your children through eggs and sperm and to your children's children. We humans, therefore, second hypothesis, corollary, are evolving ourselves. Unlike other animals, we humans are evolving ourselves for the future, for better or worse, by our thoughts and imagination.
Well, bravo. My task was easier than I thought it was going to be, and I never had to use the gong once.
I would have gonged you back.
I think you've set us a really interesting challenge there, Marilyn, as to whether the gulf can or even should be bridged. I certainly don't think it should be science versus mysticism, but...
You don't need a bridge.
Maybe we don't even need a bridge.
Just go there and then go there.
And I was wondering, we'll throw it open to the floor in a moment or two, but maybe you've got some questions for each other first. Something that struck me, you mentioned how the word, the anthropic word, the A word, has become a bit more acceptable in recent years, and how the C word, consciousness, has become a bit more acceptable. Maybe not the S word, because that's firmly in the other camp, as it were, for the moment. But I wonder slightly whether the A and the C have become more acceptable because the reductionists have devalued them, so that now the anthropic word just means, hey, what an amazing coincidence that we're here, full stop, rather than some deep underlying reason. And, well, you can explain it with a multiverse, that's just an extension of materialism. The C word, yeah, consciousness is amazing. Aren't neurons amazing? It's nothing but a load of neurons. Are we, in trying to bridge this unbridgeable gulf that shouldn't be bridged, are we at risk of devaluing things on either side of it?
Yes, part of the process of words becoming acceptable is, in some sense, changing the meaning of the word or even changing the terminology. So, for example, the reason anthropics become acceptable is because we now have a concept of a multiverse, which gives you a sort of physical basis of understanding why there can be fine tunings in one particular universe. And many physicists regard the multiverse as more respectable than the, you know, fine tuning in one universe. So it sort of legitimizes the concept of the anthropic. But other people think even the multiverse is pretty mystical. So they're different views. But and the other thing is constantly using a different word to make something respectable. So instead of referring to paranormal, you refer to anomalous, and you don't refer to spiritual, you refer to transcendental or something. You can play all sorts of games, almost political games, to try and make a subject respectable by using the right name. You know, if you want to get money for something, for a grant proposal, make sure you use the right name to describe it. Don't use the wrong word, even though it means exactly the same. If you want to get a satellite funded, make sure you get the good acronym. You know, your acronym has got to spell something really sexy, you know. It can't be just XYZ or something like that. Can I ask Peter a question? Just a short discussion. Peter, I'm fascinated, of course, in the link between physics and neuroscience, because ultimately the brain is a physical object. One thing that always fascinates me is I'm interested in the link between experience and experiment. And for example, we can take something like chakras, and you know, I'm convinced from an experiential point of view, chakras exist, and yet they don't seem to correspond to anything in the body from a Western perspective. So then I often wonder, well, is it something in the brain? Is there something in the brain which corresponds to that? You refer to the problem of energy. I mean, again, healers always talking about different forms of energy. One experiences different forms of energy, and yet the challenge with physicists is that they don't seem to correspond to any known physical form of energy. So these are two examples of the sort of paradox in the way of trying to relate experience to experiment. And I'm just interested in your perspective as a neuroscientist.
I think one of the difficulties that we have is that when we look at these, let's call them esoteric for the moment, esoteric views of the human, they come from very special people who've trained themselves in very particular ways. In other words, what they have done is they've altered their brain function, their perceptual field, what they can actually do and see. And so they're different. We can only approach that by looking at people who are trained and seeing how their brains alter. Now, that is going on with our modern neuroimaging in a very exciting way. And I think that we are beginning to get some idea of how consciousness may interact with the brain. But it's only just beginning at the moment. If you look at the brain, depends on your technology I use, you can see that a stimulus, when it comes into the brain, radiates throughout the whole brain structure. And you don't see that on blood flow methods because they're far too slow. So we actually don't have a proper model of how the brain works. But it looks as if the brain will, first of all, look at the global situation very quickly in a few microseconds, actually a few milliseconds. And then, if it's repeated, it'll come down and close in on one particular part. So we have, if you like, a repetitive brain picture. We don't have a brain assessing things. So if we want to look at the finest parts of experience, we can't do it because they're not usually held and repeated. So our modern technology won't do it. But what has become perfectly apparent to me, when you start looking at subjective experience that people have, is that the Eastern hierarchy of a series of people vibrating at different levels, I don't know what that means, but vibrating at different levels seems to be correct. And so they are, in fact, able to get a different picture of the information that is around them. So it's up to you physicists again. We need some idea of what spiritual energy is. How are you going to do it? I mean, take Merrill Wolf. He is absolutely convinced it was electrical, but that was the modern the model that he used when he became awakened. If you look at what the awakened people say now, they again are using words which we can't really understand. I don't, for example, see auras around you guys, but I have seen auras around people, but I've seen auras around people when I've been in a different state, not on substances, actually.
But Viv, what are you saying? Are you saying that you think the sort of esoteric idea of different levels of different frequencies or whatever will turn out to correspond to something in the brain? Are you saying, because you're not a reductionist, that it might not? Because there's a paradox in something you said, because I was fascinated when you said there were subcortical levels of arousal which were relating to certain experiences. But then in a certain sense, I thought you were also trying to say that there are experiences that go beyond the brain. So in some sense, you don't want to reduce all near-death experiences to some subcortical processes. So
no, you can't do it. If you're going to look at consciousness as it is, then you have to these very wide states of consciousness which don't reflect appropriately within the brain. And it's quite wrong to think that they could be, simply because our technology for understanding the brain is so limited. So you won't see the reflections within the brain. And in fact, we still don't have a proper model of consciousness. Are we talking about holograms? Are we talking about the way that energy is transferred within different structures? And they're all these quantum mechanical allegories one wants to use. But they're allegories. We actually don't know. And I think it's much better to take the position that we are looking and searching. Put up hypotheses and models and test them, rather than to feel that we actually know what consciousness is. I don't think we do.
It's not my field, obviously, but having read about it, I mean, Candace Pert would argue that the receptors for molecules of mood, neuropeptides signalling from the brain, are distributed in different amounts and different types on different organs of the body. And so that you can see that people, in a way, this makes the body the unconscious, and you can see how people express emotion by which part of the body they tense or grab. So they might feel pain in their heart or anger in their head, or, you know, they'll grab it and touch it where they feel it. So that's one hypothesis, that emotions do exist in the body in the form of these receptor molecules for the molecules of mood from the brain. And that could explain, that could have something to do with chakras, I guess. And then this other thing, which I don't understand, is why the heart is so heavily wired. I mean, we do seem to use the heart neurologically in some way, but maybe you could answer that. And then with the altered states of consciousness, as I always see it, is that, you know, that we mostly experience our mind as being concerned with survival of our physical being, or our ego, whoever our physical being considers itself to be, which anchors our consciousness very close to bodily concerns, you know, sort of yesterday and tomorrow, and lists of what you're having and what's worrying you and so on. And that being liberated from this anchoring to survival of being and bodily concerns, you would actually shut down all this signalling of the body. It would go quiet. I mean, I don't know if you can identify. Those are just hypotheses I've thought about.
No, I understand what you're saying. The argument, of course, is that we're not just brains. We are brains and bodies. And body consciousness is enormously important in terms of structuring brain function that it does. The whole idea of the heart and the neural plexuses in the heart is not really understood. But we know that there are relationships between mental state and the heart, which are very close. And we also know that esoterically, the heart, when it opens, whatever that means.
Lovely feeling.
Yeah, great feeling. But what is it? And how does it lead to awakening? That we don't fully understand. So I think that there are more questions than there are answers. But what you all might like to know, and it comes from Candace Pert's laboratory, there is a molecule that she's been working on called monomeric DAPTA. And monomeric DAPTA reinfuses the neuronal processes in the brain. And it's said to be a possible end to dementia. So if you can get hold of monomeric DAPA, all of you whose brains are wilting through the aging process might like to get hold of it.
I'll have what he's having. A good moment, I think, perhaps to open it up to the floor. Two points. One, remember that this session is called Transforming Science, so let's not just live in the past, not that we would. And secondly, as teacher said, let's not always see the same hands. Preference will be given to a hand that hasn't been up before. I can see two over there, so Eddie first, perhaps.
Marilyn, I was delighted to hear your defence of words like reductionist and materialist that are used quite promiscuously. And just because someone points out the limitations of a particular approach doesn't mean one's against it. But my question is now, over the last 40 years, how do you think evolutionary theory has changed? I was delighted to hear that Lamarckian inheritance is creeping back in. But how is the general view of evolution changing over the last, or has it changed over the last 40 years?
Well, it's not really my field, but it's as far away biologically from subcellular as you can get in biology. I mean, I don't know what other people are thinking, but I've given you what I think, that we are actually, given that the strongest environmental stimulus regulating our gene function is our thoughts, imagination, expectations, life view. And the hypothesis, this is what I said, my hypothesis is that we are actually evolving ourselves. The fact that it does go through, can go through to next generation is that one hypothesis is that we are actually evolving ourselves by the way we think. But I don't know what other evolutionary biologists, what they're saying. I mean, Chris, you suggested, you gave that book, Sean Carroll's book. What is it? Something most beautiful, Darwin's quote, countless forms, most beautiful. That's a brilliant book describing the processes of evolution over millions of years by duplication and selection, which is really easily understandable and a good read.
So the environment is not just the outer, it's the inner as well.
Well, that's...
In a sense, it's gone beyond Darwin's original...
That's just my contribution. I don't know anybody else saying that. But I'm aware, given that, as I said, your imagination fires your neurology and physiology, same as the real thing, you know, Pavlov, conditioned reflex, you know, think of something good to eat, you salivate. Think of something scary, everything in your body changes. So, and it's clear that our minds are just prattling on all the time about whether we like something, don't like something, we're scared, we're worried, we're anxious, this might happen, or what we're having for dinner, and you know, that's all going into the body. Every thought you have goes into your body and changes gene expression. And what I said is that persistent negative thought will finally, because it's sustained effect, will finally, you know, change activity of genes permanently, because those modifications are heritable cell to cell. But I don't know what evolutionary biologists are saying. I always wish we could get Steve Jones to come and give us a talk. Yeah.
Well, Elizabeth, she's exactly mentioned about the evolution, so collaboration is a part of it. Yes, Elizabeth Saturis.
We've got one at the back there. Yep.
Is that me?
David.
Just to add to something Peter said about the heart, I speak as a clinician with an interest in resilience and in dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. And then in connection with evolutionary biology, have people come across the work of Stephen Porges and the polyvagal theory, Well, I think this really helps us because Porges points out that the old idea of the autonomic nervous system just being about flight and fight and freeze, it needs to be revised. And he points out that there is an aspect of the autonomic nervous system which is fairly recently evolved. It's mammalian and it's the ventral vagus, which is myelinated. And he points out that this bit of the parasympathetic nervous system allows us to stay calm when we feel unsafe. And that the first thing that we do as higher mammals when we are threatened isn't fight and flight, it's communicate, it's affiliate, we use expression, we use vocalization, we negotiate. And that the heart has a very important role in this because much of the connection between heart and brain isn't brain to heart, it's the other way around, and that the myelinated ventral vagus in fact sends a whole load of traffic up to the cortex, which allows us to feel safe even when we're under threat. So I don't know about awakened, but in human terms, what we very much need, I think, to learn to do is, I think, open the heart, which I think probably means activate the ventral myelinated vagus, so that the brain stays awake, so we remain human under pressure. And the spiritual traditions point out that slow breathing activates sinus bradycardia, sinus arrhythmia, and that in that state, we are able to feel a little bit calmer. And then just to connect us with some of Ricky Davidson's recent work with the lamas, you know, when he said, please go into my scanner and meditate, and the lama said, well, which of my 27 meditations would you like? And the one that seemed to activate that bit of the subcortex was the compassion meditation, and only that one. And that, of course, as we know with metta bhavana, it involves coming to the heart place, which of course moves us from left to right hemisphere, from rumination to embodied thinking, and that the compassion, the connectedness, takes us into positive emotion. And so, just clinically, I'm finding that the slow breathing, the taking one's consciousness to the chest, and the opening up to positive emotion does in fact seem to do something to heart rate variability, which is accompanied in experience by a feeling of added safety and an ability to feel more safe under pressure. So there is something very interesting going on here. It's not fantastically spiritual, but it does seem to be a connection between evolution, what we can do with embodied consciousness, and our ability to be human.
Thank you. I think that's very important. It's important for two reasons. One is that a way of lowering your blood pressure is, of course, also by slow breathing. So if you actually do this as a method, you can come off your blood pressure drugs if any of you are on them. But first of all, practice it properly. And secondly, there is now the concept, we're all networks when we look at the brain. There's no longer just this happens there. It's always a network. And one of the networks which is prominent is the default mode network. The default mode network is that network which comes into play when you start idling and thinking. And most of us are in the default network mode. But in fact, it's not a terribly good mode if you want to go along a spiritual path, because it actually prevents you getting into the activation of other networks which come to the fore when you're doing various forms of meditation. So your idling and thinking is not what it's about if you're going climbing up a spiritual ladder. Keep it all quiet.
You have a quick point to follow up on
just
that?
Yeah, and then we'll go to Vanessa.
Just to continue your point, the heart, if people thought that it's only a sophisticated pump, I can see it much more than this. And this is why we've got so many connectors. So it's, I think, Claudia? Yes. I see the heart not just as a pump, but I see it as like both conductor and computer for the music for all our body. And now talking from science point of view, as you know, the heart sending signal every second or all the time, and every cell in the body can feel it. And what you talk about, the heart rate variability, is like the conductor who tell every cell in the body what to do. It's not just the blood. So in real time, if you think about this, every cell in the body not just the brain, but every cell can hear the heart all the time. And so the heart gives instructions to all the body how to react. And this is like the music, and you're not able, but you can see it, you know, with ECG on any part of the body. So it's just later I'm happy to continue about the other things, evolutionary, but not...
You've got a battery-powered conductor. Vanessa.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I have lots of questions, but I'm just going to put one to Marilyn, if I might. I was curious by what you said. You entered into sort of archetypal discourse when you said that I have the scientist, the mystic, and the poet. Mm. And I just wondered if you could explain why you think it's good to keep them separate and that they are producing separate stories, because it seems to me from what you were saying that, in fact, the poet is definitely informing your scientist, because you get a sense of awe and wonder when you look, and it's definitely affecting your reflective thoughts. And clearly that's very important if thoughts are helping us to evolve, that these three work in tandem rather than along separate stories.
Yeah, thanks for that. It's just my experience that you can't be in more than one at the same time. You might actually be in your scientist and you're making a life decision. You're weighing up the pros and cons. You're saying it really would be sensible to make that choice, and so on. And then suddenly you leap over into your poet, and your poet says, oh, but I can't. I mean, I couldn't bear to hurt that person, or I'd be so upset. And then you go back to your scientist and I say, come on, be sensible, you know. And that subjective, objective talk, you will go into one and then you'll go into another and then into the other. You can't be in both at the same time. That's what I... And then you mystic, you might go over to your mystic and he'll say, hey, you guys, maybe you better look at the bigger picture here long term, even though it would hurt you and the kids and so on to make this decision now. In the long term, it would be go with the scientist, because really it would be sensible. Or your mystic might say, why don't you put off this decision to a bit later? In other words, they talk to each other, but the important thing is to know where that you're coming from. And in terms of keeping them separate, it just was not appropriate for me to be a mystic in the lab. I mean, that's what we're about there. We're looking for facts, we're looking for evidence, we're looking for hard data. You know, if I'm sort of speculating, I can speculate quietly, you know, the what ifs and the whys, which you don't normally use in science. Of course, I can go over into my, but it doesn't work, you know, me being a mystic and a poet and a romantic in the laboratory situation, it doesn't work. And as I said, if you take your scientist and you start having an argument with a loved one and you're all being very scientific about it, again, it doesn't work. You know, they are separate. They don't have to be reconciled. They already are reconciled. But I just know from my experience, when I know that they're separate ways of knowing and being, separate ways of thinking, making choices, life's easier to know where I'm coming from and what's happening. I just found it more appropriate and easier. Because I used to be sort of equally those... I've always sort of painted and written poetry, and I've always been a mystic.
Maybe that's worked for you, but it seems to me that they are informing each other all the time, and you're just sort of moving from one modality to another, with one dominating, perhaps, in any particular moment, but I don't think they ever really disappear. But that's just my point of view.
Yeah, I think it's the way you experience it. But it's quite good to think about whether you've got conflict within and whether that's reflected without. And this science versus mysticism, where's it coming from, you know?
I'll try and give you a chance in a minute, Horace, but let's hear from Andrew, who we haven't heard from yet.
Thanks. Andrew Powell, really interesting discussion. Probably lots of you know that the heart generates the strongest electromagnetic field in the body. It extends at least 12 feet. So that may parallel the work on auras that other people have been very interested in. And it certainly it's salutary to think who you're sitting next to, and indeed who you're sleeping next to, because we're sharing each other's energy fields. It also, Marilyn's point is also interesting, that if we think about the prenatal environment, I wonder what the emotions of the mother in particular, how they affect the genetic template of the child. And the last thought is about that comment of Meister Eckhart. It's not that the soul is in the body, but the body is in the soul.
There's some reports about women who are pregnant at the time of 9/11 affecting their newborn babies, but I haven't seen any hard data about it.
Jackie and then Horace.
Right. I wanted to put to the panel an hypothesis about the possible explanation for acupuncture chakra paths. And I think if we ever come to understand it from an empirical point of view, that it will not be through neuroscience or physics, but possibly through the science of embryology. If you think of a single cell multiplying, specializing, and then think of the quantum concept that what has been contiguous is forever related, it implies some kind of channel. I don't want to hypothesize about the physical basis of the channel. But you can think that perhaps if in the development of the embryo that certain parts of the body have been developing out of one structure, that those remain related at a certain level. So that, for example, if you think of the head enfolded upon the abdomen, as it were, maybe the eyes and the ovaries or testes correspond later. Now, to investigate that, the only way you might approach it is to see that if there are perhaps some structural differences in such an organ that they are reflected perhaps in the hypothetical equivalent. I mean, that could be investigated that way, perhaps, if someone wanted to undertake it. Another metaphor for the concept might be if you imagine a child making a paper cutout and then the outfolding of that, which then reflects the same pattern in what then are distant pieces. It's just an idea. It's just a very, very basic idea, but I wanted to throw it out as maybe a basis for scientific investigation of that phenomenon that appears to be there.
Do you want to comment, Marilyn?
I really don't know how to comment about that. You're sort of suggesting some sort of entanglement or memory that is, the memory is kept from the beginning of development, who everybody was next to and who were their sister cells and so on. I just don't know, really.
We're practically out of time. I promised Horace a go, and then the final one, I think, from Ollie. Did you want one?
Additional.
Yeah.
Right. Ultra brevity, 3 points. First, Montaigne. The heart hath reasons of which the mind knows not. It may be physiologically and logically the relationship between the two should be regarded as quasi-reflexive. Second, heretically, from knowledge of my family history, I have reason to believe that deep, intensive psychotherapeutic processes may be able to reverse the neonatal traumatic hippocampal epigenetic damage of which Marilyn speaks, in which case Peter and Marie may have to teach their favourite birds a new tune, meta-epigenetics. Second, and third rather, and ultra-heretically, I've reason to suspect, conjecturally, that processes in the primordial nucleon of the Big Bang, perhaps at the origin of life on Earth, highly probably at the human genetic bottleneck, and almost certainly at the quantum mesoscopic genetic origin of each individual give rise via quantum entanglement and slow motion as per electron quantum non-locality to those genuine phenomena described as psi phenomena and give rise to a psi-connected universe and particularly to the existence of what might be called quantum soul.
Wow. Do you want very quickly to comment?
Well, I'll just briefly comment on the last of your many interesting points, Horace, when you referred to the quantum entanglement. I deliberately didn't even touch on the subject of parapsychology because of a shortage of time, but it is, of course, one which does directly link with physics because it involves a physical interaction. And obviously, most paraphysicists are particularly interested in the quantum link. And now, you know, the buzzword now is non-local, which is all to do with quantum entanglement. I mean, I think even Jackie referred to quantum in her comment. And I will only say my personal view is I do think that, you know, the quantum is part of the solution. If you like, quantum entanglement, it's such a basic concept, it's got to be part of the solution. I don't think it's the whole solution. I think that we need a paradigm shift which goes beyond straight quantum entanglement. My paradigm shift is this higher dimensional one, but I think I think it does have to involve that anyway.
Yes. I agree on
but it's not the whole story.
Final one from Ollie.
Thank you, Martin. So I've just been reading a book. This is picking up on something that Bernard said right at the beginning about science transforming us. Mm-hmm. And I've just been reading a book by Brian Swim where he points out that we're very bad at this. So that even when we have scientific knowledge, we still have a habit of perceiving the world in a pre-scientific way. For example, he gives two simple examples. Number one, pretty much everyone still tends to see the sun setting and rising, even though we know it doesn't. So we still see the sun in a pre-scientific way, even though we know scientifically that it's the Earth moving. Another one, he says, is that we still think of that as up and that as down, and that we're standing on the Earth, which is scientific rubbish. And that he says that both of those, you can reprogram your perception to see the world in a new way. He says he's even gone so far as to see himself dangling off the bottom of the Earth, with that being down and that being up, and him being sort of sucked onto the Earth, which is just as scientifically accurate as our pre-scientific experience of that being down and that being up, which is very primeval, really. And he says, and he's also taught himself to see the sunset and sunrise in the way that it's the Earth moving, not the sun. But he did it through meditations, doing experiences, practices, where he embeds the science in him. And I think this is something that the network could think about.
Thank you. I should just mention on that point of a friend of mine who managed to travel to Antarctica, to the South Pole, where there is a pole labelled South Pole. Got a friend to take a photo while they did a handstand on it, turn it the other way up, and it looks as if they're hanging on the underneath of the Earth. You've more or less taken my summing up line there, because I was going to just come back and talk about not only us transforming science, but how science transforms us. I think it really is a two-way process. I think you mentioned, Bernard, how information by itself does not reach wisdom. I think, I forget who it was who said it originally. I think I heard it from Dr. Francis Rolls, but he may have been quoting someone else when he said that wisdom is the combination of knowledge and being. And I think the important thing in this is to remember the being side. And personally, I don't mind if science ultimately explains the mystery, if it finds consciousness in some tiny Planck scale space between the neurons or not. It's still a wonderful mystery, and we're very fortunate to have both the scientist and the mystic, separate or together. In a moment, I'm going to blow out the candle and ring the gong, at which point we are all going to go very quickly out onto the gravel for a photo. Before that, I would like you all to thank our three illustrious scientists and mystics.